Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.
Hello and welcome to episode 149 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret. Never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. And on this episode of the podcast, I am joined by another huge talent, a singer, songwriter, musician, producer, sound artist, Gwen R. She's another of those incredible talents to have entered Paul Weller's orbit. First, as somebody whose music he has regularly recommended, and then as a remixer for one of his songs from On Sunset in 2020. Her own creations are things of beauty, sung in Cornish and or Welsh, hypnotic with gorgeous, enchanting melodies, a captivating blend of dreamy synth pop, and those stunning, beautiful vocals that transport us listeners to otherworldly realms. I encourage you to check out her work today. It's a real sonic journey that immerses audiences in a unique and introspective musical experience. Fabulous stuff. Let's get into it. Gwen R., thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.
This is going to be a cracker. Look, I'm really interested in you, your story, the music, the inspiration, your process. I mean, how are we going to fit all this in? I don't know. How you create, and ultimately, most of all, these remarkable sounds that you bring us on your albums, your songs, they're just beautiful.
Thank you very much. It's very, very kind of you. Thank
and
you.
And every album is different every time, but unmistakably you.
Yeah, I think, well, I make all my records with Rhys Edwards, my husband, and we've made records now together for 10 years. Which is a really interesting process in itself because we keep working together. The challenge is to find something new in that relationship, in a way, creative relationship. And I suppose it's more similar to what it'd be like in a band, in a way. So you've got to kind of spark each other off. I'm really proud of that because I think long lasting creative relationships are really interesting and important, actually, in terms of the longevity of them and the commitment to them as well. And as much as I love, you know, collaborating and buzzing around, I kind of always felt like that, even though I had quite clear ideas about the sort of kind of solo records I wanted to make. It's been really lovely to have a collaborator, and I'm a very collaborative artist, definitely.
My wife would say the prospect of working with me day in, day out on anything, quite frankly, would be horrendous because I'm such a control freak. How do you make that dynamic work? Do you have sign off and ultimate say because it's coming from your name when you put it out in the world? Or
yeah, but I think it's. I mean, we're both control freaks, so I think it's just finding your match in a way, and the meticulousness of it as well. I think we're both like that in terms of detail, is very, very important to both of us. So it's been a sort of sanctuary in a way to find someone as obsessive as I am, and in different areas of it as well, I think, because I think we do contribute different things. And also I think the dynamic constantly changes with the albums, I think, because I've been doing a lot of remix work and I've been doing a lot more work remotely on my own electronically. And I think that's contributed more and more to the records that we make together as well, which has been exciting. And thinking about the next album, we're really, really taking that process on board as being very much part of the next album and how we make it.
We'll talk about remix and the Weller connections, and we'll get into all of that as well. Yeah, and how we got to now, how we got to your most recent album, which is just incredible as well. And this music being so special. So we'll weave all this in, all these stories all the way through. But let's kick off with this love of music, because that's at the heart of it. And growing up, we're going to hear about your story, and you know, your dad's Cornish, your mum's Welsh, and we can hear that the Welsh in your beautiful accent as well. But you were raised as bilingual. So was music a thing in your household? Was it a thing when you were growing up?
My sister and I were raised in a bilingual household, in the sense that it was was a Welsh and Cornish speaking household, so we didn't have any English at home. And then a lot of music that we heard and that was played to us as children would have been Cornish, Breton, Irish, Welsh, mostly, and music from further afield as well, but not really anything from the Anglo-American canon, which certainly when I got to become a teenager made me feel very, very out of step, because everyone else had the sort of the background of, you know, Motown, for example, a lot of 60s bands that would have influenced a lot on the Britpop era that I hadn't actually listened to or hadn't been around really.
Wow, so you're discovering like the Beatles and
Think, and it's talking about that in this era sounds insane, because you can't control what your children consume really anymore. But I think we were probably the last generation where, you know, my mum could stop us from watching English TV. She, you know, we could not have English radio on in the house. And really, apart from sneaking, you know, culture from from friends or whatever or at school, like they had ultimate control. So there's the control freakness comes from, probably. But so it was a kind of an odd upbringing in a way, in that sense. And so I always felt a sort of slightly distance to sort of just regular mainstream pop culture in a way. But then that helped, I suppose. I came at it quite excitedly then, and I ultimately joined, you know, an English indie pop band that was very much influenced by Motown and girl groups. I think from having the background that I've had, I've always been interested in alternative histories in a way. And I think particularly with the Pipettes, the band from Brighton that I joined, you know, the whole purpose of that band was to say, well, look, what else was happening at the time? Everyone keeps going on about the Stones and the Beatles and all of that stuff, but what other music was happening? And certainly those girl groups were really, really influential, you know, the Shangri-Las and all of those bands. So it's helped. I've sort of turned it into a positive rather than just feel like, I'm so detached from culture. So, and for me, I think as well, when you're raised in Wales in a Welsh speaking community in a way, even though I grew up in Cardiff, there's a lot of Welsh around outside of school as well. You do feel it's like you're slightly out of step with, again, sort of mainstream popular culture, because you also have your own culture. And again, you know, I don't think that's particularly unique either, because I think lots of people have different cultures at home and then they are part of, you know, a bigger mainstream English speaking culture as well. So it's always about what the importance of those languages and cultures are to you and where they fit. And I think there are times when my Welsh and Cornish cultures are more important and they're more prominent in my life. And then there are times when English culture has been more prominent in my life, and it depends where I am in my life and what I'm doing, I suppose.
And how do you take that on now? I mean, you've got two children, you just had another baby very recently. How do you take that on as a parent? You know, what's your philosophy? Like in a world where they can, what, like you say, consume whatever they want at the touch of a button with an iPad?
Yeah, well, my attitude with both my children, because I speak Cornish to both of them, and the reason I do it is because the Cornish language holds a lot of really, really positive, very warming, comforting memories for me as a language, because I remember it as the comforting element in my childhood. And I see it as a childhood language as well, just because it's a language that I speak to with my dad. So I've given it to them, but I have no control of whether they want it or not. And I just always felt like, you know, if I think as a parent, and if you're able to do it, and it's not always easy, I think when you move countries and you are trying to integrate with a new country, there are so many people that think, well, you know, it's best to take the view that you just integrate and you forget about that old culture. So everyone has their own way of doing it as a parent, but I definitely felt like, well, I've been given this thing, and there's a little bit of like, I'm just going to give it to you, and if you don't want it, doesn't matter. And also, well, if I've had to have it, it's like a hot potato a little bit as well. It's like, well, if I've had to have it, you can have it as well.
Whether you want it or not, yeah.
Yeah, but there's no pressure, but I think it helps them connect with their granddads, and it helps them understand a part of their mum's life that has been really important and they've been a part of as well, and that their dad's life as well. Really, because we've been making everything together. So it's just about, there's no reason not to pass it on. And it, you know, it only betters my Cornish language skills anyway, because I have to use it every day.
Yeah. Well, and I love the connections of this and how you talk about the importance of this throughout the albums and every time you release an album and things like that as well. So we'll dig into some of those things. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about was, and again, this was about growing up, because we've heard about Paul Weller on the podcast and Red Wedge and Billy Bragg and the politics and the activism in his lyrics. benefits for miners and others. You also come from a really politicised background as well, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, my mum's in the Socialist Street Choir and they've been going for 40 years. They were actually on a record with Billy Bragg.
Oh, brilliant. I didn't know that.
Ago. Yeah, they sang the Internationale with him. And actually, I think my mum's chart position has been higher than mine. So she's kind of won.
She hasn't got a Mercury Music shortlist though, right?
So, you know. Swings and roundabouts. But yeah, so that is, it has been really prominent. And I think if you're from Wales and if you're from post-industrial landscape anywhere in the UK, actually, you're quite, or, you know, a multicultural area or, you know, or an inner city area, you're going to be really aware of the struggles, I think, that a lot of people have had. And I think there is, I can kind of romanticize, I think, about that. In the 80s, you know, because I was just dragged along to, you know.
Well, like demos and stuff.
Oh, so many. It was ridiculous. Anti-apartheid, demos and all of that stuff. And obviously Red Wedgwood have been quite integrated with a lot of what the punk bands in Wales were doing as well. It's part of the fabric. And I think, because especially when I think about my mum's choir during that period, you know, there was a lot of, they basically just sang the sort of socialist hits. So they'd sing a lot of South African songs. They'd sing a lot of, yeah, because obviously the miners' strike was, you know, it was sort of the tail end of that I can remember because obviously it was 84. And it was just, it felt like there was a real celebration. And a lot of the women from Greenham would have been tied in with what the choir were doing and were members of the choir as well. So, it was just this hotbed. And it felt like there was a common thread between all of the activism that was going on. And I think the world is quite different now. And I think because the world, the only world that we had was a physical one, it meant that people were very much getting together all the time in person and discussing their different issues. And I think that the movement of people, and I don't think you need to put it on a spectrum of left or right, you know, or whatever. It's about the importance of people was really prominent and felt very, very strong. And I, you know, obviously it's a period of post-industrialization where people still remember the collective. So I definitely, and it's easy to romanticize that because obviously, you know, there was a lot wrong with it. But I do just vividly remember as a child how many different voices there were. And the people, particularly around my mum's choir in South Wales, they weren't all the same person. There were so many people from different walks of life, but they all had a common goal, really. And it was human rights and it was bettering everyone's position. So, yeah, I can feel quite nostalgic and romantic about that, I think, in a world where things have changed so much.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Now, this is the Paul Weller Fan Podcast, and we'll dig into your story and your links with Mr. Weller, which actually, from my understanding from and my introduction to you was through that first album and actually through him. I guess there are two questions. So one, when did you first become aware of Paul and his music? Because you weren't brought up on the Jam and the Style Council for the reasons we just talked about, right? And then when did you discover that Paul was into your stuff?
Well, I think, obviously, Paul's music is just, it's part of the air, isn't it? For us all, in a way. I mean, it's incredible, really, that the achievement of that, that it's just part of everyday life. But I think Paul's work became more prominent for me when I was living in Brighton. And there was a lot, I mean, his influence was really, really strong there on a lot of the music that was being made, really, and certainly had parallels with it as well. And then I read it, or he may have told Jeff, actually, from Heavenly Runs Heavenly, because they're good friends, you know, that he'd really, really liked our records, which was amazing because Shreese is a massive fan of the Style Council as well. And obviously we're huge fans of the fact that his evolution as an artist as well, you know, it's the fact that he has changed and he has developed and he's evolved while still making amazing pop songs, which is feels like the ultimately what the goal is, and still is, you know, is making those classic songs. So yeah, it's sort of gradually grown, and then we've been in touch and he's been so supportive, and, you know, we've just been, you know, texting or whatever. And I remember he was down in Cornwall, I think it was the year before, and he'd say, oh, how do you say thank you, or like good night, good evening in Cornish. So it's just these,
so
like,
he's dropping back little voice notes or sending it phonetically.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just like amazing interest and sensitivity to other artists, because, you know, we're just like, you know, small artists back in Cardiff doing and making our records at home, and the fact that somebody so influential really has taken an interest and supported us is amazing. And I think those relationships are really, really important, I think, to artists, because you're always looking up to someone. You're like, you need that guidance in a way. And I think when you get that reassurance from someone who you really respect, it gives you a lot of confidence, and it's very reassuring. She's like, oh, maybe it's okay. You know, it's a huge thing. So yeah, we've been really grateful, and we'd love to, you know, we talk about, I was like, oh, it'd be really nice. I really enjoyed remix simple songs, and it would be really lovely to try and collaborate in some way. Cause I think, like you said, you know, I think that we do have things in common from a philosophical point of view as well. So it would be great to collaborate, I think.
Okay, well, we'll talk about some of these connections, these memories, because you're right, that mention in a magazine must mean so much. I mean, there was a photo of Paul rehearsing yesterday for the upcoming tour, and he's got a podcast mug in front of him. And that alone to me was just like, oh my God, it's going to happen. You know, I mean, that stamp of approval, I guess, is such an important thing, because it introduces you to a wider audience, obviously. He's like an influencer.
Oh, absolutely. And it does so much. And I think that, yeah, because you do trust voices that have created amazing work themselves, don't you? So the fact that they say, oh, well, listen to this, then you do realize how many people are going to go, yeah, right then, and think, oh, well, if, you know, Paul Weller's saying it's all right, there must be something in it, you know?
Now, you mentioned the Pipettes, and I wanted to talk to you. So you joined in 2005.
I did.
Via an amazing detour to Vegas, which we should come back to in a bit, not least because my grandparents, bless them, who are no longer with us, but would never forgive me if I didn't ask you about the Michael Flatley stories. But you actually played on the bill with Weller a couple of festivals on that. One of them was the Pyramid stage at Glastonbury, admittedly like different ends of the day and all that.
Very different ends. Yeah.
I don't know if you stuck around and saw his performance or if you remember that at all.
Gosh, I don't remember much from that Glastonbury apart from, oh, I need to go on stage and I've been here all weekend. That was, you know, apart from that, and then thinking, I'm just never going to camp at a festival again when I need to play ever again. I mean, it's a bit different when you're in your 20s because you're like, oh, whatever, you just roll out of bed, don't you? But yeah, no, I don't think I did. I'm trying to think.
Let me tell you the lineup. I mean, the lineup was incredible for Glastonbury. So we had C6 Steve on the same
day. I remember him. Yeah, because he was, because we met him in Oslo before he put a record out. And he was there with his old car and his 8-track tapes in the car. I just remember, yeah, I mean, he supported the Pipettes in Oslo. That's how we met him first.
Oh, wicked. That's great. Yeah. Funny enough, he's just come up on the podcast recently for that Later with Jules Holland performance on Hootenanny. Yeah. And how incredible that was. But people like Lily Allen were on there. Paolo Nutini, The Kooks, The Killers, Dirty Pretty Things. And then, yeah, the Pipettes. And then also there was another one actually just before that, which was the previous year was V Festival. You were on the same bill as...
I vaguely remember being backstage when Paul was there. I do vaguely remember because we'd always go, oh my God, look who's there. There was a lot of that going on with us because we were like, oh my God, what are we doing here? Look at those people. Yeah. And I do remember us going, oh my God, it's Paul Weller.
Now I'm going to fast forward to the solo stuff, right? Yeah. So, and I'd like you, as we go through, to correct my pronunciation so I can, we can teach this as a bit of education as well, so I can learn something and I'll do some practice. But let's talk about this. So the debut solo album, this is October 2014, this was out. I'm going to say A Dyred Olaf.
Really? It's A Dyred Olaf.
Okay.
Not bad.
Which means the last day. Yeah,
the final day, yeah.
And Uncut Magazine, I don't know, you might not remember this, when was this? It was January 2016. And you were interviewed actually, right at the front of it, you were interviewed by a chap called Tom Pinnock. So you might well have read this issue. I don't know if you like reading your own stuff. Film Me Full of Dreads, you know, what did I say and all that? But,
sometimes I do. I don't read it straight away, but I do read it after because I can't read it straight away because I'm like, oh my God, did I say something wrong?
So this would have been released actually, thinking about it, been released around Christmas time because they come out a bit earlier, don't they? And there was a Weller mention in it, right? So there was an interview with him. He was on tour at the time and it said, and I'll read it to you, it said that the band had come off stage buzzing. There's no time to celebrate. After a quick change of clothes, Weller hands over a CD to listen to, and it was your first album.
Wow.
And then he shouts farewell to the journalist. He disappears down the stairs. The band follow him, and that was it. And he was handing them out as albums that he recommends and likes.
Wow. That's amazing, isn't it?
Isn't that cool?
Oh, that's amazing. God, thanks for sharing that. That's amazing.
Yeah, really nice. I'll send you the little link as well. So this album wins Welsh Music Prize, Welsh Album of the Year. So we'll talk about the differences in selecting the language. I don't know, you know, how you approached that. This was a Welsh album. The other albums have been mostly Cornish. And this album, production techniques, you mentioned your husband. I'm guessing this is a collaboration between the two of you. But there were lots of field recordings on this. You're out and about in Cardiff at home there recording stuff, right?
Yeah, and it was a record that came together over, I'm trying to think when we started working on it. It must have been, Yeah, no, it was about 3 years. We do take a while to make great, but it comes from that in the fact that we do collect a lot of field recordings that create that sort of sonic palette. And it was always about creating a landscape with the sound. We're trying to create worlds, I think, ultimately. And that record was inspired by the sci-fi novel that, Oh, I Know Wine, who's a nuclear scientist, wrote a book called Adith Olav that was published in the 70s. It was written in 1968. And what it was about was godlike AI. And oh. Yeah,
it's topical for now, right?
Oh, no, honestly, I guess quite scared because I think that the conversation up until this, you know, quite recently in the press, really, I've been reading articles about it, has been very, very pro AI, pro developing technology, you know, and it's sort of, you're a bit of a Luddite if you're not getting it on there with algorithm and stuff. But I think the conversation that's happening now seems really like it's scarily close to what this book is about. And it's something that he predicted in the 60s that was going to happen. Ultimately, we were going to be taken over by robot AI overlords. And then that would be the end of that. And they'd sort of destroy everybody. So it's a very dystopian novel. And it's funny because I was, you know, The reason I was drawn to the book and those themes was that Wales is often seen as a very romantic, you know, full of poets kind of place and this beautiful landscape. And actually, and you know, even in our national anthem, we say, you know, the land of bards and singers. And I've always felt that our scientists have been really, really important to the culture in general and to the evolution of thought as well in Wales and in the Welsh language as well. I always couldn't believe when I found this book, because I was like, this is exactly what I was looking for. And I know I did actually predict the future. And he also predicted a lot of things like how kids would learn, because he sort of predicted the internet. There would be this tool on this machine that would give all the information so kids wouldn't need to actually remember all of this stuff. They could just use it as a tool for further developing their thoughts. So he's a really, really interesting character. I was kind of searching, having not sang in Welsh for about a decade, I was sort of searching for something exciting within the culture for me to sort of get back into it and not sort of rehash old tropes, or just more of a sort of, kind of a... What's the word? Sorry. I've spoken English for ages. Like a research project, you know?
Yeah. I love that. The fact that you're kind of discovering this, but then that's the inspiration for an album.
It coincided. I was searching for this thing, I think. I was searching for ideas about the future from a technological point of view, because that was kind of all happening in beginning of the, what do you call them? Like the 2010s.
Yeah, I don't know. Has it got a name? Don't know if it has, is it?
Yeah.
The tens sounds crap. I know what you mean.
Tens. Yeah, it was kind of, everything was all, it was, everyone was sort of discussing that and thinking about futures and where did technology fit in with it?
Yeah.
And then I made that record that was quite dystopian, and then so much has happened within music and people go, no, it's great. Let's like, you know, use technology to like, you know, and people have created their own AIs and stuff like this. And I've always been like, I don't know about this. I don't know. I'm not sure. Now with this conversation that's really interesting and scary of people going, yeah, well, what ultimately everyone is after that's in power right now is to create this godlike AI that's basically going to take over and make human beings completely redundant. And I'm like, oh my God. So, whoa, that is relevant. You know, so I was kind of searching for other things, because I think it's also with themes as well, it's about finding the human, you know, the humanity in it. And I think ultimately that is a very important influence on what I try to do. And it comes from my background and, you know, growing up, is that people are really important. I really do believe in sort of human beings. I'm not that as interested in the detachment that technology creates. I, as a facilitator for more communications and stronger bonds between people, I think great. But other than that, I'm not. I'm like, meh.
Are you always looking for a theme for the album, something to hook it around?
I think so. I think that instinctively I do, because it's what drives my need to try and express something as well. But that can be a nothing as well. Like, you know, I was trying not to with Trezor. I think as you get older as well, and as an artist, like we're going into fourth record now, which is still not many, but it's, you get to a quite a nice place with your fourth album, is that you're on such a mission for the first few records, because you're like trying to prove a point to yourself, really. And you're quite focused and like pushing. But I'm quite excited because I always admire, like I love all of Leonard Cohen's final records. I think they're just amazing. You know, like I think even as a 20-year-old, I was like, I can't wait to be like wise and old, you know, just to be able to share that wisdom. Yeah. I think it's the wisdom that I really love in songs. And obviously my age, but I think definitely as I get older, I'm searching for wisdom and answers from songwriters as well. And, you know, some people hit it when they're so young and they can tell, you know, the whole truth. But it's a journey as well for a lot of artists and songwriters that you get to. But yeah, that's the kind of point I want to reach. It's like, it's a song's a song, and perhaps there isn't a theme. Perhaps the theme is just being a human being, you know, that kind of quite interested in that as an idea as well. Having not done that much. I did it a bit with Trezor, just like his life, you know, there's a lot to be said about it. But I think it's different as well what type of artist that you are, because I think probably I am some kind of conceptual artist, and especially more now that the visuals are becoming part of what I do. But nothing beats a good song telling you how it is. And that's, I'm not sure if I feel like I still need to write that song. You know,
I like that. Yeah, keep pushing forward. What's the next thing? All that.
Yeah.
Actually, when you're talking there are three people who are connected with Paul that I wonder if you've discovered. And I'm going to mention, so because you love the electronica was this, you know, a big thing for you in that sense. So there are three people who have two have been on the podcast. So Hannah Peel,
yes,
who you know, Fur Wave and these amazing soundtracks and things. And there are similarities with, I think there are similarities with you and the three of the people I'm going to mention. Doss Allison, who you must have loved from like One Love and all that, right? I would guess, but she's back with Heart Shaped Scars, which is a fabulous LP.
Yeah.
And then a chap called Erland Cooper, who again, I don't know if you've come across Erland.
Yeah. Right? Hannah and Erland, I've come across. And it's funny with Hannah, because I love Hannah's work and we've never met.
Have you not?
And I feel like we're in the similar circles in terms of like, there's a lot of like cross pollination that happens, and we've never met. We've never been in the same place at the same time. So I really look forward to meeting her. And I think her work is brilliant and really, really interesting. And again, she toys with concepts and does more of the electronic thing and does a lot of orchestral work, which is amazing. Yeah, like so many, our paths should have crossed because similar people, or the same people, you know, at different points. So yeah, like Para Orchestra, I sang with last year, and obviously she's done a lot with Para Orchestra. So yeah, all fantastic. So yeah,
well, we need to make this happen, Hannah, if you're listening. Let's sort this out. Okay?
Definitely. Yeah,
I'm going to talk about your second album now. So this means in English A Place of Memory, and this is Lakov.
Yeah, I learned my lesson, you see, because I thought, right, I've got to make this really, really easy to say to pronounce.
But this is Cornish rather than Welsh,
and it's in Cornish because I think, I mean, I put records out on Heavenly Recording. So we initially put a D-Dollar out on Pesky Records, which is Rhys's label, which is now defunct. And which was a Welsh label that'd been going for a decade, put Kate Le Bon's early records out. Really good label. I was chuffed to be on it. And then Jeff picked a D-Dollar. And what was great about the whole experience with a D-Dollar and Heavenly was anything goes. Like Jeff's just like, all right, yeah, go then. And you're like,
nice.
All right. Okay.
So you don't have to compromise on anything. It's just...
No, not at all. Because Jeff's very much, what's your idea? What do you want to do? And you're like, okay, well, you got to come up with an idea. Brilliant. So that's the challenge in a way. And if it's a good enough idea and you can explain yourself, Jeff's like, yeah, great. You know, because it's if you can write a song, great. If you can make the music good, do what you want. So after that experience, I was so reassured, because we always had this thing, was like, oh, music's just music, you know, it doesn't really matter what language it's in, it really doesn't, does it? Because people love a tune, like we all love a tune, don't we? It doesn't really matter. And then that got me really excited. I was like, all right, okay, well, if I've done a Welsh record, then I should just do a Cornish one, because that's even more of a challenge, because actually there are over, it's like there's over 500,000 Welsh speakers in the world or something, or maybe there's 750,000, and there's like 200 people that speak Cornish. I was like, oh, amazing. And there's the challenge. Like if I was putting my money where my mouth is, really going, right, if you think music is music and language doesn't matter, then use a language that no one understands and see what happens, just as a challenge.
It's almost that kind of, like a little bit of arrogancy there as well, isn't there? I'm just kind of like, yeah, I'm just kind of gonna do it.
Well, it's not arrogance. It's more like anarchy, I'd say, because I think a lot about that with artists is that we are anarchists, yeah, ultimately, yeah, because what you do every time you make something, you've got to smash the thing you've made up and you've got to start again. Or otherwise you're in this weird static temple of your own self, which is like really disgusting. I think that was what it was to do with, was going, okay, well, what's the biggest, biggest risk that we could take? And it's not risky, you know, people are doing very, very risky things. It's not particularly risky, but it was the risk that was worth taking in our, you know, it was like, do the thing that you shouldn't, that wouldn't be expected for you to do. That's where it was coming from, really. Nice. And see what happens. Cause I think also when you make stuff, whether it be music, whether it be, you know, art, film, you've got to make it not knowing what the outcome is, and you've got to make it not knowing what the reaction is going to be either. And I think that's where things get really exciting, because you're just throwing caution to the wind, going, let's just try this thing. It's not there yet, but I wonder what will happen when it exists.
And to say that it works, I mean, not obviously not everything is for a critic, but my goodness me. And you don't design these things and create these things for the critics, but people absolutely love this album. It got, you know, it was in every best ofs of the year, you know, the Guardian, Uncut, Mojo, and even Mr. Weller, little other connection. Don't know again if you know this. He featured in his list, Uncut Magazine, his end of the year roundup. He featured it as one of his favorite albums.
Yeah. Amazing. I remember that one. We were like, oh, amazing. Again, brilliant. So and I think, but again, it's that thing, it's like, if you can make, I think making things that other artists like as well is really,
yeah, you get a buzz out,
you know, because definitely, because I think not all stuff is made and other artists like it necessarily. So when that does happen, you're like, oh, amazing.
Well, there have been enough occasions where Paul's given things an absolute slagging as well. So, you know,
exactly. This is it. So, exactly. So to be on the right side is a good thing, I think.
I remember seeing at that time, we talked later, actually, earlier on, didn't we? Later with Jules Holland at that time, which would have been what? Your TV debut, I would guess, was it?
It was. Oh, we loved every minute of it. It was so brilliant because we do everything ourselves. I tour manage myself, we do all the records ourselves, all of that, so we're pretty hands-on, and we really like being like that. And I think for me, the reason that I'm like that is because I've had few successes and a lot of failures, so I kind of, with music, it's so up and down, and one minute it's happening and the next minute it's not. And I think the more control you have over what's happening, the easier it is to cope with it, with the sort of peaks and troughs of it. Personally, I think that from my point of view. But what was great was just the mechanics of the master sort of structure of later with Jules Holland, because the program's been going on for so many decades, how well an oiled a machine it is.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just gorgeous to walk into. So not just thinking, oh, here's my performance, is you're walking into this environment where everyone is just like so on it, and you're like, oh my god, this is just bliss, because so much of music is absolute chaos. So when you know, in terms of like gigs and all of that stuff, it's like, oh my god, are we gonna get there on time and all of this stuff. When you do walk into a working environment like that, you're just like, ah, and relax, and actually you can perform much better because there's, you know, everything's in its place, you know, and it's just, you've got nothing to worry about.
Nice. And on the lineup, so the Manics were on that lineup.
Yeah.
Really great friends of yours now, and you've been on each other's records and stuff. And an artist called Ray LaMontagne, who I absolutely adore as well.
Of course. Yeah, he did the really quiet song as well, didn't he?
Was it You're the Best? I'm trying to think what he sang at that. But anyway, he's fabulous. And this was a song, again, let's see if I can do with the pronunciation. This is the constant education, folks. Tier Harmore. It's obviously in the lyrics, so it's a bit easier, which means land and sea, right?
Yeah, that was the first song I wrote for Le Corve as a record. And it was a song I wrote about an artist called Peter Lanyon, who was an abstract landscape painter from St. Ives. And who, weirdly, because I came across his work, and I can't remember where I came across it. Oh, yeah, it was The Art of Cornwall. I don't know if you ever saw that series on BBC. It was really great. So I came across his work there and hadn't realized, actually, that my dad's a published poet, and all of his published works have Peter Lanyon artworks on the cover. And I hadn't realized, and I was like, so that was really nice.
What a nice connection.
Yeah, it was a great connection. I hadn't realized was there, because I just found Peter Lanyon very inspiring in the sense that he was very Cornish, you know, was very grounded in his culture and community, but was trying to create an abstract impression of what that was. And I think, again, you know, when it comes to cultural identity, things can become quite rigid visually and philosophically and all of those things. And I think that it can become quite dangerous in terms of nationalism and things like that. But I think that when you have artists that keep pushing what the idea of the identity is in a very, very, and pushing it to abstraction, it gets really, really exciting because it allows for a lot of space for interpretation and for different ways of being within that culture as well. So that was really the starting point for Le Corbe, was like, okay, what is it? Because I speak Cornish. I'm not Cornish. You know, I speak Cornish. It's not my fault I speak Cornish. So someone the other day said, I thought you just learned it in lockdown. And I was just like, oh, wait. You know, I wish it was that easy for me just to go, oh, I'm bored of it now. I'm just going to do something else. But yeah, it's part of me, you know, and it's this weird, like, it's this very, it's not weird. It's just a very unexpected part of me in a way. It's just like, I speak Cornish and that's that. And I've never lived there. And so Le Corbe really, I was, and then, you know, I wrote all of these songs because I had all of this stuff that I'd grown up digesting really in terms of ideas and identity, all of those things. And I was like, well, I can't base this record in Cornwall because I've never lived there. And so Le Corbe became this place that was a sunken city, like, there's Lyoness, you know, I don't know if you know those. There's a lot of Celtic sunken cities.
Okay.
Around the coast of, Wales, Britain and, Brittany, but all these sunken cities that are sunken because of sin. And then, you know, all the water comes flooding in. And I really liked that as a concept. I thought, yeah, that's the city I live in. Speaking
nice,
Cornish
nice.
And imagining this other place. So it's not me in any way claiming here's a record about Cornwall in the 21st century. I was very conscious that that was something I could never, ever do because that's not my experience. You know, I live in Cardiff.
But then for the third album, and again, every time you're building and, you know, the audience is growing, the second album, you're suddenly touring the world. I mean, I bet you can't imagine that these things are connecting in the way that they are. But for the third album, you did go to Cornwall to start writing it, right? To St. Ives?
It did. It's sort of in reaction to Le Corbe in a way. Because okay. I was like, okay, then. Again, you know, this isn't a flight of fancy. This language is not something I can just drop because I stopped doing my Duolingo or whatever. So with that in mind, what would it be like for me to write a record in Cornwall? What happens then? And like the sort of quite isolated feeling, you know, this was January 2020. So there was rumors about some COVID.
Yeah, we hadn't locked down at that point, had we? Or
no,
even understood what was about to happen.
No,
really.
We were like, I remember doing, we did a performance at the VFI and people were talking about this flu thing that was happening. And we were all like, yeah, whatever. And then I went down to Cornwall and I stayed there for a week and I wrote a record. So it became more personal and intimate then. It was responding to not belonging there, but then wanting to try and connect with it as well. And St. Ives in the winter is a very isolated place because obviously it's so full, particularly in the town, it's so full of holiday homes that there aren't as many people around. So you become really conscious and aware of that impact on Cornwall as well. But I was trying to tap into the atmosphere and I felt like I didn't want to attempt to say anything political. I wanted to say emotions. And I felt like, well, if I created a record in Cornwall, I'm not even giving, like with Trezor, it's like, I wasn't trying to do any gimmicks or like, oh, it's about this. Can, you know, it was just like, oh, these are songs and they're feelings because actually I haven't learned this language. It's a language I can really feel in, like very deeply.
You don't have to think about it at all, right? It's just ingrained within you. Yeah.
And then so that was, it was like, what would that, does that translate? Like if I just make a record that just tries to be really intimate and really beautiful, what does that do? How does that turn out? So that was the idea with that one. And it sort of tied in. It was weird because I felt a need to slow down and the pandemic hadn't happened. It was odd because I was like, oh, I really want to slow down and be a bit quieter. And then the pandemic, I was like, all right, there we go.
You were forced.
So I will. Yeah. Yeah, there we are then. Yeah.
Yeah. And we get to hear that album obviously in 2022. But in the meantime, 2020, so around that time of lockdown, we got the release of Paul Weller's On Sunset album. And you know, a remarkable album when, and interesting actually, when you talked about Leonard Cohen, it made me think of Paul and the amount of albums he's releasing and this great work that's coming, you know, towards the latter part of his career. Let's talk about it like that. And On Sunset was just a fabulous piece of work. But then we then later on, a few months later, we get the remix EP, which I've got here. Here we are. And what is it?
Oh, yeah.
Side A, track two, Old Father Time, Gwenna remix. So how did this all come about? Were you, when did you connect with Paul properly? When were you exchanging texts and things like that? Talk me through the story.
Yeah, it was during the pandemic, actually. I think he got that we were in touch on text, actually. And then, you know what? It was a real godsend that he asked me to do that remix, because those things really kept me going during the pandemic, because obviously you couldn't tour. It was odd because it's for musicians, it was like, oh, okay, it's delayed. So you're very, very used to things changing in music. It's not like going to the same job every day. It's like going to your job and saying, oh, this job's not going to happen today. It's going to happen next month. So you're used to that sort of mindset and the flexibility of that, you know, but it's obviously as it went on and on, it's like, oh, okay, so this isn't happening at all. Yeah, doing that remix was really nourishing, because it was a way of collaborating remotely. I love, love, love remixing people's work. And it's because I think I'm such an introvert. It's a really nice way of being able to connect with other musicians without having to go in and jam in a room or whatever. Because I think... Yeah. It's quite an interesting.
Yeah, the pressure of writing lyrics next to each other and
all of that stuff, yeah. Which I was just like, it takes me such a long time to get to know anybody. So it was just such a joy to do that. And I sort of reversed all the vocals, because I think it was, I'm trying to think if it was the first, because I did a lot of remixes during the pandemic, but I think that was one of the first. So I was really trying to sort of pull things apart and just trying to bring more of the electronic element into the work. So yeah, no, it was great. You know, I just really love, it's like cooking remixing, because what you do is you chop everything up, like you're chopping your onions and your carrots and your celery. So you got your sofrito mix on the bottom.
Yeah.
And then you've got to think about which ingredients, what herbs and spices you want to add. And so yeah, I find it very similar to cooking, and I really like it for that reason. It's like all the chopping up. I love chopping.
So what does he send you in a let's keep with this cooking theme, if it's like a HelloFresh box is arriving, what do you get in the email?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm just saying, the thing, like the base of it is like, I guess it is all the drums and bass and things, because it's all those guitar elements. And I was, yeah, and we had back and forth as well. And
does he give you any type of brief on what he's after?
No, but he was responding then, and it was really encouraging. It's just like, I think we went through, because a long time, it was like, how many years? Like 3 years ago now, isn't it? We were just going through vocals, really, because I'd reversed all the vocals. I just liked that. So, I'd love to hear Paul Weller not singing in English, because that was my thing. That's why I kind of went for that. It's like, be interesting, because obviously he's got this, like, such a distinctive voice. That's what's another thing that's fantastic with remixes. You get to know people's voices. It's really nice, because you're just constantly just listening to vocals. I just really, really enjoyed it. It was good fun.
You also want to do something that's different, right? And I think that's what you've, I mean, you really have transformed that track.
Because I think with remixing for me, it's always about trying to get to the essence of a song, like something that may have been missed. So you're like, you're sort of reinterpretation of the same thing. So you're like, oh, what's the thing that really stands out, and what's that you feel this song's about? And then you try and you're searching for that when you're remixing. That's what I do anyway, because I kind of, it's a way of getting to know a song, because it's all chopped, you know, you're getting stems. So you're really getting to know a song and things that may not even be the main hook of a song, of the song originally. You think, ah, oh, yeah, but that bit, I feel like that bit was the bit for me that makes the song. So you sort of go after that and develop a new song around it, almost. Because I still see them as songs, really, rather than remixes.
You're looking at it and going, I really love the carrots. Let's have more of the carrots.
Yeah.
Making more of a meal of that bit. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd love to get those. But that comes over like a WeTransfer with the stems and the different layered files and stuff. And suddenly you're unpicking it. It's just, that's a joy in itself, let alone then rebuilding it, you know.
Well, it takes me more time to pull it apart than it does to rebuild, because I chop it up so finely. But it's only because I don't want to miss. I'm quite thorough with that. Like, I do loads of chopping. I'm very good at prep. Yeah, well, I'm a sous chef.
Yeah. This is all done at home, presumably. Well, it must be lockdown, right?
So yeah, we were at home. So it was really nice, because it just made me feel part of the world. Yeah. At a point where I didn't, really. And we were lucky. Everyone's had such a different pandemic. It's just, it's crazy, isn't it? It's like, there is like the before time and the after time. My son was 4 when the pandemic started, and he can't really remember things before. Like he
no, that's
remember.
The same as mine. Yeah, my youngest is.
Yeah, I just can't remember it. I mean, he remembers the pandemic, but he doesn't remember anything before it. We did so much traveling. Like we took him everywhere with us touring because there was no other way of doing it. And he doesn't remember any of it. I'm like, oh.
The places he's been, he hasn't got a clue.
I know. I guess I'm like, oh, do you remember being in Berlin? He's like, no. Oh.
So let's talk 2022, that third album, Tresor, pronunciation right?
Mm-hmm.
This means treasure in Cornish, and it's mostly sung in Cornish, but there is a Welsh song called Wales Is Not For Sale is the English translation.
Well, this is it with the record, I was saying to you, the record is like, yeah, I'm going to make a very nice, quiet album. There's no singles on it and it'll be lovely and intimate just to see what that's like. I ultimately always want to write a pop song. I sort of get drawn to doing it. And I was like, oh, what if you don't do that? Like try and write songs that aren't trying to do that. And then we sent the record to Heavenly. And this is the only time Jeff's intervened. He's like, I can't hear any singles, Gwen. What's going on? I was like, there are no singles, Jeff. This is how it is. And he's like, well, that's, you know, come on. You can do a sing. Come on, give us a song. And then Therese and I were so furious that he had said that. It's really funny. We were like, what? We were so furious that we wrote Wales Is Not For Sale. So I thought, well, right. You know what? If you want a single, I'll give you a single. I'll give a very highly politicized single that probably won't appeal to anybody. And I'm really glad he did that because it was sort of, it's that thing of like, you need the tension to come from somewhere. Mm. And I think that when you've been working with the label for such a long time, they know you, you know them. You can take offense, but you take it with a pinch of salt because ultimately, like, it's probably right.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really important creative relationship that with a label that you can have those kind of conversations with.
Often you hear of that kind of friction that doesn't end in anybody being really happy with what they're ending up with.
Yeah.
And I think Weller's gone through that with the Style Council and even the Jam when he delivered All My Cons and it got rejected or whatever. But when it works, and that's a collaboration again, isn't it? When it works, it adds to the album, it adds to the experience all round.
It does. And I think, because I remember, I think we delivered the song. And Jeff's like, yeah, great. Okay, move on. You know, he didn't even say, oh, that's amazing. He didn't even say that. He's just like, yep, thank you.
Yeah, done.
And it's a good story because I like it. You know, it's like you sort of deliver one thing. And I don't know. I mean, both of us, we're open to all of that. I much prefer someone say, well, that's a bit rubbish. You know, I'd rather someone was honest with me than just go, oh, yeah, that's great. You know, it's even things like, you know, probably you learn the most from the criticisms that you get, you know, as a musician, and not necessarily, there are some criticism you think, well, actually, that's not very well grounded and you actually don't know what you're talking about. But there are those, then you think, well, you've got a point. Actually, I'll bear that in mind. You know, you learn from, you learn from those reactions and you learn from, you know, especially if someone's saying it because they've considered what they're saying to you and they sort of know you. I mean, that's the thing. That's, again, you know, I've been on Heavenly for such a long time now that you just kind of go, well, you do respect that point of view, really. And you can either respond to it. You know, if I didn't think that we could do with a song that was more like a single, I wouldn't have done it. I thought, oh, well, do you know what? I'll give it a go.
It also shows the value of a label, I think, where obviously it's their job to get used to as wide an audience as they possibly can, right?
I was making an album. I was like, oh, here's my album that I don't want anyone to hear. And they're like, well, what's the point of that?
Yeah. You know?
So it was right.
Well, look, thank you, Mr. VD. I mean, remarkable reviews for this LP, huge across the board. Were there any duff ones? Were there any bad reviews that you're aware of? I don't think.
No.
Was there probably a one star anywhere? I didn't see it.
Somewhere. Do you know, it's that thing as well. I think I read a lot of music writing and I really value music writing. I think it's really important. It's shaped a lot of, you know, I love reading about music. I love reading about, you know, it really, I want to know, like, what's the story? Why was this made? When was it made? Who are these people? I love the story around music. So I think music writers and music critics are important. But I think it's always about, like, respecting the amount of work it takes to make something as well, you know, and like, and how you, I think there was, it's interesting. So I think perhaps like 10, 15 years ago, it was quite vicious and really bitchy and mean. Some music writing, perhaps on the internet, I don't know. And I feel like it has changed. I think there's more empathy to, you know, the person that's writing is probably not getting paid very much to do it, and the person that's making it certainly isn't. So, like, let's just be a little bit more empathetic to each other and actually work out what the thing is that's wrong with this, rather than, oh, this is rubbish, get it in the bin kind of thing.
Something that's still a little bit weird. I think this is the same true of film as well, where there's like a scoring mechanism. Do you know what I mean? Like, being scored on work is a bit strange in that sense, I think. So, you know, it's about the reviews and the writing ups and how people are digging into what the albums mean to them and the songs mean to them, and is as much about, you know, less so the 4 or 5 stars, although that looks good on a poster, I suppose.
That's it. Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think maybe we don't need the stars and the numbers as much as we need the writing and the sort of trying to define what the work is about, which is, I just always find really interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's been fascinating reading, actually doing the research for this episode of the podcast as well, because I dug into lots more of the conversations you'd had about the album, learned more about the album and things like that, which is fascinating too. And obviously shortlisted for a Mercury Music Prize. Again, it's not all about the awards, but it's very nice when they come, because again, it introduces you to a wider audience. But for this one, I think I'm right in saying, is it the first Mercury Music Prize nomination or shortlist where it's not sung in English?
Yeah. How nuts is that? Like, I think that's bonkers.
That's mad. What's it like? 30 years, is it now, the Mercury Music Prize?
It's just weird. I just find that strange. So we're like, we're super chuffed that we're the first, but kind of, it's kind of
like
nuts.
Also, what the heck, how, you know.
Yeah, it's odd, because I think, it's really odd, but fantastic, you know. It was, it's just one of those things, isn't it? Really unexpected, because Fiona, my manager, was calling me. I was like, oh no, something really horrible's happened, because I kept missing her calls. I wasn't expecting that. I was like, oh no, I've got four missed calls. This isn't good. It was like a sigh of relief, and also obviously chuffed to bits, couldn't quite believe it. Because it was really, really unexpected, and a great experience. And because the thing is for us, you see, because like we're in Wales, and you're like, obviously my label's in London, and even like the Heavenly community and the Caught by the River community is really lovely. So I mean, because I think when you go into something like the Mercury, you're walking into something where there's like lots of different areas of the music industry are there, rather than just indie, for example, because it's like the bubble that I'm in. I really love being in it. And it's like, there's a lot of like-minded souls, and it's a way of life and all of that stuff. And then obviously, when you're walking into something like that, there's just lots of different levels of commercialism and all of that stuff. So you're getting, and it's just something that I haven't been around for years, really, because I just do my own thing and over there. So yeah, it was just really interesting from a like sociology point of view, I guess.
Well, we also got the live performance on the TV, which was an absolute joy as well. Now, this album is in all the album of the year lists everywhere again, Enemy, Mojo, Uncut. Every time we're building and building and building in your bubble. But Mr. Weller again calls this album out in like a proper full article as well. And he says, I really love the album. This is her best so far. She sings in Cornish and Welsh, so I've no idea what the lyrics are about, but the sound of the words, it's so beautiful and evocative. And I thought that was a really interesting point to bring up as well. And you've mentioned it. It's like, actually, it feels like it's less important for people to understand what the songs are saying, because we don't speak Cornish or Welsh. But for him, it's actually all about the sound of it and the experience of it, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. And obviously that fits in with what the music that we're trying to make. And yeah, it's fascinating. And because we made 3 albums now, and they do feel like a trilogy. Because I feel like they're the trilogy of childhood. That's what it feels like to me.
And I was going to call them a trilogy, and then I thought, is that right? I don't know. I think of them that way, yeah.
Because it's about exploring that identity that you're given without choice and working out what that is and where it fits in. I'm quite interested in looking at it as a trilogy of exploration. And I'm quite excited about the feeling I've got at the moment. It's like I'm sort of ready to walk out the front door, because I've obviously been in the house and it's been in my imagination, and it's been about that other world, constant other world, which is a huge influence on my creative thinking. It's always about being about making other worlds. So
as you talk there, it feels like, is there a world for creativity outside of the music? I know you're doing more of the visual stuff, and you know, so much, you mentioned video and things, and there's like a short film that goes with this album as well. But outside of that, in terms of literature and things like that, is that something you'd ever explore, like writing a book?
No.
It's a lot of work, obviously, right?
Yeah. I mean, I left school when I was 16, so I don't know. I mean, I did a I did do an online course during the pandemic because I left when I was 16 because I went to dance, and then so I didn't do my A levels. So I've done an AS course now because it was annoying me. I was like, I couldn't even apply to go to university if I wanted to. And that was something that I thought about a lot in my 20s. I always felt slightly inadequate that I hadn't had a higher education because I was around a lot of people that had. But as I've grown older, I've sort of learned that I sort of learn myself anyway. And it was also a rejection because my parents are both academic and we, yeah, it's like survival as well. I don't know. I always, because I was like, I'm not great at school in terms of like, no, it's a big end, it's trouble all the time. But I always had a house full of books. So I was really lucky. So I was kind of like, oh, I'll get my education from somewhere. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, yeah, I'll be all right.
Yeah, but it was obviously, it was a bit of a like gung-ho attitude. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's about evolving. I've also that, you know, that having had that experience of theatre, and I did do a theatre production before the pandemic as well. It all ties in. I saw this great Laurie Anderson interview yesterday online, and she's just like, don't restrict yourself. Like, because she calls herself, I think she calls herself a multimedia artist. Because she's like, well, if I'm a multimedia artist, it's so vague. Like, if I make an album and then all of a sudden I've done something else that's nothing to do with music, then people aren't going to question me. And I think as creative people that we are, you know, and we all are inevitably not restricting yourself too much to one thing. But also I think that's the thing with like language as well for me is like, just use everything you've got in the toolbox. I was going to make myself a t-shirt like, I am not a linguist, you know, because people assume that I'm a linguist, that I'm just obsessed with languages. It's like, I'm really not. I literally, I'm just using them to just get out of my system. And just because it's just there and it just feels like the right thing. I just picked it up and gone, oh, that's, you know, I was in a English indie pop band for however many years singing in English and quite happy about it. So it's not like, I think it's always about not restricting yourself creatively at all. And that's why I'm quite excited now, because I've made 3 records and it feels like a really good time to think about a different direction, because like I've done it. And also the goal, I think definitely the goal was to normalize the experience of having those languages, because I've been such a huge fan of a lot of people that have made amazing music in Welsh and Cornish. And I just kind of wanted to share that and go, oh yeah, you know, there's all this amazing music in Welsh and Cornish. You just perhaps you haven't heard it, but it's kind of a normal thing. It's not a novelty. It's not like, and there's nothing special about
it. You're not a one-off.
It's nothing special. It's just music and it's all part of the same fabric. That's why I've found so encouraging with that experience that I've had over the past decade is how open people are. Like, I've never had a sniff of like, why are you singing in Welsh? Why are you singing? And we play so many gigs in England, across England, and all we get is like super positive, really interested. There's no lack of connection from expressing your point of view because people relate to it from their point of view. It's just that simple. And music's just so amazing for that. It's like the best tool in the box, really, because it's the one art form that everyone understands, like without question, and everyone can enjoy as well. It's very magical.
Oh, no, totally. Because it's that connection. You're right. It's like how this album means something to people who don't, like, you know, when we listen, we're in it, you feel it. I don't understand the words, and I have looked them up because they're on your website as well. You have the translation, but in a way, I'm like, I don't need that actually.
No. That's not, you know, well, you don't do because it's yours. No. And once it's out in the world, it becomes something else.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's exciting thinking, being able to make records for the rest of my life, really, and then being different things and getting better. That's the other thing about music is that I just knew, because I was a dancer originally as a profession, and I lasted about 4 years. And what I loved about music, and it was something I was drawn to straight away, was I was just never going to get to the bottom of it. Like, I would never, ever, get to the bottom of it. Because there's so much music in the world. There's so many different ways of making it. It changes all the time within different circumstances and communities. You never get to the bottom of it. And I was like, oh, that's probably a good mission for life then. I'm never going to be able to go, oh, well, that's finished. I've done that. Then.
Complete. Yeah. Game over. Done. Yeah.
It's just not like that. So I knew music was the one for me. And the other thing with music I find is that it draws people that don't fit into anywhere else to it. And I think ultimately it's about the community that it creates around it, because I think music is a lot for all of us that probably don't fit in anywhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. I get you totally. I have to ask, I said I would. So this, the dance stuff was Michael Flatley in Vegas, right?
That's it.
This is Lord of the Dance, Feet of Flames.
Yeah. So I did, I auditioned when I was 15 in Dublin. And again, you know, cause it's a bit of a tear away, and I just happened to do Irish dancing because my dad speaks Irish and had a friend, and I went there since I was 5, and we used to just go like to Splott, which is, there are a lot of, it's a, an Irish community in Splott, South Cardiff, pay 50p every class every Friday. I just remember walking there in the rain and then competing, and then got this job and then auditioned with Michael Flatley in Germany, and then got sent to Las Vegas to do the lead part in the New York Hotel when I was 17, I think. And then we did like, how many shows we were talking? There were 6 days a week, and it would be, I think there were like 2 or 3 matinees as well. Just pretty hardcore, kind of nuts, because coming from Wales, like, so green, so full of history and culture and all that stuff, and then going to the middle of a desert, which like yeah, every building kept getting knocked down. And I remember going then, I remember reading a Lonely Planet guide before I went. And so I had an image in my head of what Las Vegas was. And I, for some reason, I thought it was going to be a lot closer to what New York is. I don't know why. And then I just couldn't believe how empty it was. It's a really strange place. And I feel really, I've been thinking a lot about Las Vegas recently. Cause it's funny. Cause when I tell people, Americans, oh, I lived in Las Vegas, they'd always say, oh yeah, that's nothing like America. And that's kind of like, well, it's kind of like part of America.
Yeah.
And America's so, yeah, you know, North America's so different. You know, the United States is just like, every state is so different from the other. But it has had an influence on me. You know, as a 17-year-old, just like when I started, you know, listening to music, really, and getting into bands, and not being able to see any bands because we were doing shows. Yeah, becoming aware of Elvis, obviously.
Of course.
Which actually, yeah. I sort of was quite dismissive of Elvis when I lived in Las Vegas. And then as soon as I went home, I really, really got into Elvis. I love Elvis, and I really loved his Vegas period. I just love, like, the end of Elvis. Elvis, I love.
Those shows are mental, aren't they?
Oh, they're absolutely great. I just like,
brilliant, yeah.
Oh, I just can't help believing it's one of my favorite Elvis shows. Yeah. Just like so saccharine and like over the top, and yeah, love. So yeah, it's funny. So it's definitely had a sort of delayed influence on me in a way.
You forget how huge that all was. Like, this is off the back of Riverdance, right? Mm-hmm. So, and Michael Flatley, that whole show was massive. It was huge.
They played the Oscars the year before I joined. They did the variety performance. It was of the moment, for, you know, five. And that was weird because, you know, coming from a very Celtic, restricted, you know, culturally background, and all of a sudden all the stuff that I got to do instead of ballet or whatever was the center of culture.
Yeah,
was
proper,
was
yeah,
like. But then obviously I got excited then, because when I lived in Las Vegas, all the Welsh bands started doing well, you know, like Furries and Catatonia and Mannix. And I was like, oh my God, Wales is the center of the earth. This is insane. And actually that was quite integral to the reason why I was like, do you know what? Music, like there's something happening, and I don't know what, you know, I was just drawn to it. I didn't know, you know, how to be part of it or what to do or anything. I was just kind of like, oh, that's exciting. And it did make part of the reason why I wanted to come home, really. I missed home, but also I was like, there's life here. From, you know, especially coming from a place where your culture's never seen, all of a sudden it was. I was like, oh my God, it's part of the world. That's amazing.
Love that. I love that. All from over the other side of the pond, seeing that back in. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Hey, look, this has been so lovely hearing your stories. Honestly, a fabulous experience.
Thanks for having me on. So, yeah, yapping along. Yeah.
No, honestly, and thank you for the music. I mean, the albums, the trilogy of albums has been an absolute delight. And look, we look forward to whatever comes next, as you say.
Thank you.
We're into that. Live performances this summer. So we've got some festival dates already, like Latitude and Blue Dot and things like that. Mm-hmm. Will there be another tour soon of you? Or obviously there's a lot going on with Parenthood again and all that as well.
Yeah,
right?
But it's always good to do all together. I get quite energized by it. I love everything's together. It's, you know, because for us, it's just like life, family, music. It's all part of the same thing. You know, it's not separate at all. But we're hoping this, I'm hoping to do something quite special towards the end of the year to sort of celebrate the three records. It hasn't been announced yet, but I'm hoping to do something, which would be nice, I think, just to sort of tie up the year and whilst we're making our next record as well.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, we'll look out for that. That's really exciting. I do have two final questions for you before you go. So you're allowed one Paul Weller song for the rest of your life. Oh, it can be the, it can be the Jam. It can be the Jam, the Style Council, or Solo. I mean, I'm aware that you probably don't, they probably aren't even any of the Jam or the Style Council songs, you know, having been deprived.
I mean, obviously the first one is Town Called Malice, just because it was the girl group thing. I think it's just that because it's probably the song that I think of Brighton. I think of that song because it was everywhere and still, you know, it was everywhere, even 2005. So, and it's a great beat. You know, it comes on and you're like, yeah, it's the hit, isn't it? It might not, he's got so many hits, but yeah, that's the one that, that's my short-term answer. I might come back to you on that one. I'll have to email you or something.
All right. Okay. Let me
that's
know.
The we one can... that's come to my head, because obviously that's the one that is the most familiar to me just because of the Brighton connection, I think. Because when I think of Brighton, I think of Paul Weller. And it's just the mod thing. So
yeah. And then final question. So the purpose of this podcast, I don't know if you know, I can't remember if I've explained this. So the purpose of this podcast, so I used to be a radio presenter. I gave up being a radio presenter. And my one big regret was never getting to interview Paul Weller. So during lockdown, you know, we all had nothing to do. I created a podcast. We're now 3 years. This is year number three. But the whole point of creating the podcast was to get an interview with Paul Weller. That was, you know, just to tick that box. So as much as I love hearing your stories and we've dug into your memories and talked about your music and all that, the end goal is to get the interview with Mr. Weller, okay?
Amazing. So oh my God, that's such, you're making such an effort. That's 3 years. That's amazing.
Back in the day, journalists just used to be able to ring up his family home and they'd get an interview. But I mean, we're having to put in the work now. We're on episode 140 plus, you know.
That's amazing. But would you stop the podcast if you got your interview?
Yeah, I haven't thought of a series two idea. So yeah, it finishes.
Maybe that's
at that
why
point.
He's not going to do an interview. Because he thinks, I'm really enjoying this podcast. I don't want to stop the man.
If it happens and I get to interview him, what would you like to know? What would you think I should ask him?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a really good question. What would I like to ask him? Oh, would he ever sing in another language? Because obviously I've tried to make him sing in another language by reversing all his vocals. But I would like to ask him, would he be up for singing in a, would he ever be up for singing a song in Welsh with me?
That's nice. He's done a little bit of French on a bit of Style Council-y stuff, hasn't he?
But, oh, there we go. He's done
but like a proper,
but not
proper...
a minority Celtic language.
Exactly.
That's my niche. Yeah.
Oh dear. Hey, look, this has been so lovely. I really enjoyed chatting with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thanks so much.
My thanks once again to Gwen R. Saunders. What a guest, an incredible talent. And do check out that trilogy of albums that we talked about. All the details in the show notes for this podcast. Just go to my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Loads of videos, links to the music on there as well. And whilst you're there, don't forget to head into my store. You can get yourself some official podcast merchandise, from mugs to t-shirts and much more. Plus, you can buy a virtual coffee if you'd like to do that as well. Thank you so much to you if you've got involved. Hello to Richard Hawthorne. Thank you, Richard. Much appreciated to you for your generosity. He says, I've just found your podcast and I'm starting my journey. I love it. Just finished Alan McGee. Amazing what he did with his church. Got you some backdated brews now. I am 10% of the way in. Any plans to get Steve White on? If I get a shout out, I will get to hear it eventually. Brilliant. Richard, thank you. Welcome to the podcast. And yes, we'd love Whitey on, obviously. Hello to Ian Hamilton. Thank you to you for your virtual coffee. Hello, Grant. Thanks to you, sir. Hello to Duncan. Hi, Ian. Hello, Sean Wilson. Thank you to you for your virtual coffee. Hello to Rich Gill. Peter E has got in touch and bought a virtual coffee as well. As has Martin Bonhom. Mike C. Hello also to Vinyl Soul. Says, great every week, Dan. Keep up the great work. Well, thank you to you, Vinyl Soul, and love your artwork as well. Hello to Simon Carslidge, Martin Glover, James Headley, who says, Sarah Jane Morris, wow, what a find. Like most of your podcasts, makes me search or listen to albums of Paul Weller or new material. Was there since 77, and I'm betting the best interview is going to be yours. No freaking doubt. Brilliant. Thank you, James. Much appreciated. If you want to get involved, head to my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. You can also get in touch on Twitter, @WellerFanPod, or on Instagram and Facebook, you'll find me by searching Paul Weller Fan Podcast. And on the next episode of the podcast, we're there. Episode 150. I can say no more, but you are going to want to join for this one. Make sure you follow, you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, anywhere in the podcast universe, you will find this. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.